WNF is the radio sponsor for the Tampa Bay Living Green Expo at the Coliseum in St. Petersburg, April 2nd and 3rd. The Tampa Bay Living Green Expo explores solutions for people to live better, healthier lives with less impact on the environment. More at PinellasGreenLivingExpo.org. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'm really delighted to be bringing you another edition of Talking Animals, in which we'll be speaking in detail about guide dogs with Heidi Ilgen. First, though, as always, we're kicking off the show with an animal tune. This is Was Not Was with What Up Dog here on Talking Animals.
Got this new pit bull terrier. Thing's better than a credit card. Went to the gas station the other day. Got a couple gallons of gas, some oil, spark plug, six pack. Man says that'll be $15.41. I say, well, goddamn, I forgot my wallet, but I did bring my credit card.
That was not was with What Up Dog. Classic animal tune of sorts sees us in today's edition of Talking Animals. My name is Duncan Strauss, here with our program that is devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be speaking with today's guest, Heidi Ilgen, a dog trainer at Southeastern Guide Dogs, where she's worked for nearly 20 years. We'll find out about Southeastern Guide Dogs itself, a prominent facility headquartered in Palmetto, Florida, the array of programs they maintain, how they train the dogs, how some might branch into different kinds of service, and more. Let me speak with Heidi Ilgen in a few moments here on Talking Animals. And as usual, we'll also welcome your questions and comments at 813-239-9663 or by email at dj@wmnf.org. Also, a bit later in the show, we'll step into the comedy corner, play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a pair of tickets to see Paul and Fred Taggart from Little Feet do an acoustic show tomorrow, March 24th, at the Capitol Theater. And we'll speak with Connie Brooks, a locally based and nationally recognized expert on responding to disasters that affect animals, from hurricanes to oil spills, and ways to prepare your pets and household for disasters of that and other kinds. This will serve as a sneak preview for the talk show delivered at the Talking Animals Festival, one of five talks we've scheduled for that day. And our spring fun drive is just around the corner, beginning April 6th. Talking Animals will be among the first shows seeking your pledges, but maybe you'd like to help before that day. We have this cool thing called the tip jar. Go to WMNF.org, find Talking Animals on the Wednesday schedule at 11 a.m. Click on that and maybe put a few bucks in the tip jar. Get us off to a head start. We'd appreciate it. Right now, though, it's time for animal news and announcements. Look at items of interest in animal news locally, regionally, nationally, sometimes internationally, as well as announcements of local events. So let's turn now to items of interest in animal news and as well as local announcements on the horizon. We, of course, always welcome your comments. You can share those instantly by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. All right, let's talk turkey, as it were. Produced by the Talking Animals award-winning Rip and Read News Department, our first item involves, not coincidentally, guide dogs. saw this a few places online in the last few days. But anyway, I think this came from AOL News or some aggregate. Anyway, sometimes it says man's best friends need a little help of his own. Graham Wasp counted on his guide dog, a yellow Labrador named Edward, for 6 years. So Wasp wasn't about to give up on him when cataracts left Edward blind. The 6-year-old man and his wife Sandra kept a loyal four-legged helper and adopted a second dog to help lead both man and dog together. The new Labrador, a 2-year-old female named Opal, has become fast friends with her predecessor. Quote, they become quite good friends and get on happily together. Wasp, who lives in England and is partially blind, told the New York Daily News. There are certain times, I'm sure, where Opal will help and Edward is happier by having another dog around. The trio now visits local schools to raise awareness for the blind and guide dogs, and Wasp says Edward is still much beloved. Quote, he is still very popular, just as much, if not more, than before, told Daily Mail in London. So, good story, and coincidental, but coolly coincidental. All right. Talk we're going to have in a few minutes with Heidi Elgin. So, this comes from my side of the state. Palm Beach Post last week reports that the Palm Beach County Commissioners passed a sweeping ordinance Tuesday that deeply rewrites the rules on animals, most prominently adding layers of restrictions to how dogs and cats are bought and cared for. The 6-0 vote, Commissioner Paulette Burdick was out sick, was met by a burst of applause from supporters. Before the decision, the board heard comments on the measure from almost 2 dozen people, split between animal rights activists praising the rules as progressive and hunters and guard dog companies deriding them as unreasonable. When outdoors, dogs can no longer be left tied up or put in pens smaller than 80 square feet. Pet stores must disclose the medical histories and birthplaces of individual animals, and guard dogs now must be licensed and stored in cages of a certain size. The massive overhaul is a major victory for Palm Beach County's animal rights activists, changing scores of rules down to whether a squawking bird can be a nuisance, yes, if it's a parrot, and whether bestiality is legal. Not anymore, though because of state law, it's only a civil penalty. The bulk of the rules, though, are specific to dogs and cats, addressing recent controversies surrounding dogs left sweltering in the summer heat and puppies imported from out of state. And this leads us right into tonight, Wednesday, March 23rd, a final decision will be announced regarding the dog chaining slash tethering ordinance pending in Hillsborough County. That's going to be at 6:30 p.m. It's going to be at the County Center Building, second floor, downtown Tampa. That's 601 East Kennedy Boulevard in Tampa, 33602. And we've talked about and talked with Barbara Lopresti, kind of the key person organizing this effort. And I think she is out of town, but there have been a number of meetings like this one. And she has invited all kinds of people to show up. And I guess there hasn't been a great turnout, so she's really urging people, if you care about how and for how long and under what circumstances dogs can be tethered and chained outside, to turn up at this meeting tonight, the 23rd, voice your opinion and give a voice to those dogs who don't have one. And sort of just finishing up here in a moment or two, we've got, of course, a little rest in peace for Newt, the polar bear whose famously cute visage landed him a Vanity Fair cover and earned him legions of fans back when he was a cub in 2006 and 2007. Died over the weekend of unknown causes. The celebrity bear, who was 4, died in his outdoor enclosure at the Berlin Zoo. Zoo staffers are anxious to determine the cause of Newt's early death, considered extremely unusual for a species that can live up to 20 years in the wild and even longer in captivity. Newt had not appeared sick before his death, and he was visible to 600 or 700 people gathered around the zoo's polar bear enclosure at the time of his death on Saturday. Locally, a fundraiser for a rescue, new to me at least, called Raffle Rescue, Inc., and they're having an event March 26th from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. at Tarpon Springs Castle Winery, and it'll be Sultans, Gypsies, Belly Dancers, and all kinds of other things, food and wines, whatever, to raise funds for them. So more information at 727-697-7034 for tickets, or just generally 727-947-7029. Okay, and I think we're sort of rounding into the perhaps inevitable now portion devoted to the Talking Animals Festival. Again, that's going to be April 3rd. Coming up now, a little over a week from this coming Sunday at Lowry Park, right next door to the zoo. And it's going to be from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. We're going to have 13, count them, 13 bands doing animal songs. And we're going to have all kinds of vendors and tablers. We're going to have great vegan and vegetarian food and speakers and contests. And we've got a bounce house, courtesy of Bounce Away Bouncers. We've got soccer-playing dogs. These are soccer collies, folks, and they're quite amazing. We saw them at Lowry Park last Wednesday after the show. And so kids are invited to wear their soccer uniforms and play against these two dogs, Miss Z and Beck, and you can try to defend against them, but I can tell you, they will score. They will score every time. They're quite amazing. So anyways, they'll be there at the festival, again, the Bounce House. Also, we had, for the first festival last year, we had quite a turnout, sort of the proverbial good problem to have. And at points, I know parking wasn't as great as it should have been for folks. So we've come up with a number of measures to improve upon that this year. And so first of all, of course, the festival is free to attend, and parking is free. But we've also arranged for two different sort of satellite parking lots, one at the American Legion Hall nearby, about 0.7 mile away, and also at the Lowry Park Church at north of the zoo, also 0.7 mile away. But even if you don't feel like walking, folks, we've arranged for a shuttle. So anyway, we'll have more details about that. We have the location information already on talkinganimals.net, and we'll give you more details about the shuttle and stuff in the coming days. But it's we're making it easy for you to go and have fun and park and enjoy. So and we can still use a few more volunteers. It's a big operation, and like WMNF itself, it's volunteer powered. So if you'd like to help out for an hour or two, you can contact Talking Animals at WMNF.org or Don D, as in Don, at WMNF.org. So and we've got all kinds of other cool things, but let's move on now, if we can, to the Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which involves animal-oriented comedy. We always do a short piece when we have an in-studio guest, as Heidi is today. So here's Todd Berry with a portion of a piece called Prairie Dogs on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
Been in D.C., huh? Washington, D.C.? Yeah. It's the nation's capital. I went there. I went to the zoo. By myself, because I wanted to see pandas, and I followed the signs to the pandas, and right before the exhibit of pandas, there's an exhibit of prairie dogs. I don't know if you've ever seen a prairie dog, but they are adorable. They are staggeringly cute. They're unbelievably cute. We're just jaw-dropping. And I saw the prairie dogs. Then I saw the pandas. I was like, oh, that's cool, but I kind of want to see more prairie dogs. And at that point, I realized what it must be like to be in the audience of a show where I am the opening act.
Okay. That's Todd Berry. With a portion of a piece called Prairie Dogs, taken from his CD, From Heaven. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net. It's nearly time to meet today's guest, Heidi Ilgen. As I mentioned earlier in the show, Heidi's a dog trainer at Southeastern Guide Dogs, where she's worked for nearly 20 years. There's more I could probably say, but she's right here in the studio, so we should hear what she has to say. With a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Heidi Ilgen to Talking Animals. Hello, Heidi.
Hi, how are you?
Really great, and as I kind of alluded to beforehand, we're off the air. So happy to have an in-studio guest. It just doesn't happen often enough for my preference. So anyways, thank you for coming, and welcome. So there's just so many things I'm interested in discussing with you and learning, but I thought we might start by addressing things that many might need to sort of unlearn. What's the biggest misconception surrounding guide dogs, would you say?
I would say one of the biggest misconceptions is a lot of people think that the dogs don't enjoy what they're doing, and that is a big falsification. These dogs absolutely love what they're doing. They're raised and bred primarily. They were hunting dogs, retrieving dogs, and we're filtering that energy into a different field. And when these dogs see the harnesses and their leashes and collars come out, they're more than happy to go to work and do a job. And the personality that you see with them is an attestment to that. And when you ask most people, wouldn't you love to bring your dog to work with you every day or go with you every place that you travel, most people would love to be able to do that. So for a person who is blind, it's a wonderful thing to be able to gain independence, but they also take this wonderful companionship that they gain with them everywhere they go with their dog.
So I should mention that you did bring a dog with you today, the lovely Sandy. And perhaps I should also say that when you first got to the station and we kind of introduced ourselves, I asked about touching or petting, Sandy. I mean, first of all, do people tend to do this or not do this, or what do you find in your experience?
I think a lot of people want to reach out and touch the dog because they are bred and raised to be very social and friendly, because they do have to go out into the general public. And most of us are animal lovers. I would say probably 90% of the people that are on this earth are animal lovers. And it's a natural instinct to want to reach out and pet a dog, especially when they personify a very friendly attitude. But it can be very dangerous for the blind person if you do reach out and pet the dog when it's in its harness, which is in its work mode, because it can become a distraction to somebody who cannot see. And, you know, the danger is that one day you may be across the street and the dog is so used to seeing you and getting attention that the dog may actually want to go across the street to say hello. So as hard as it is, it's better to ask the person who has the dog if you're allowed to pet it, if it's okay. And sometimes the person will say it's okay, but they'd like to take the equipment off the harness that the dog is in so the dog knows when it's on and off duty.
Yeah, I think that's really – I mean, I think a lot of people know that, but I think some people are uncertain. And, you know, as we talked before, I kind of err on the side of being careful. So I asked you if I could touch or not touch pet Sandy. And so it was interesting because, as you just referred to, you said, yeah, but let me take her harness off first. And then I and others in the lobby petted her. And then I noted not long after that you put the harness back on, because I guess that's part of her sort of final training is, hey, you know, you're basically on duty right now.
Correct. It also is a way to identify that this is a guide dog. It shows that this dog was trained by an accredited guide dog school. It's proof for the general population when you go into places that this dog is a trained guide dog from an accredited establishment. So it's a way to identify the dog as well. You know, there's so many people out there now that want to bring their dogs in, and they try to sneak their dogs into different places. And this is just one way for us, not only for the dog to be able to guide, of course, because that's the way the dog is helping guide the blind person, but it's a way to identify that the dog came from an accredited school, that it was raised, brought up, and trained by a business, by an establishment that strictly trains these dogs and gets them conditioned to be able to go into these public places.
So does that mean that if we're trying to pay attention and maybe, you know, learn something here, that by virtue of, in this case at least, and maybe others similar, having a harness, people should just, whether it's marked in any way or not, but by virtue of the harness itself, should always ask about touching or petting, and probably assume from what you said that probably wouldn't be great for that dog, because again, you're trying to like say, hey, this dog's on duty, and the example you gave of if you got to know that dog a few times and you saw him across the street, something unfortunate might happen.
Correct. And there are several guide dog schools across the United States, and all of the bigger schools do have harnesses that they provide for the dog. This is the way the person holds on to the harness and the dog starts to guide the person. And it is a way to identify that this dog is some type of service dog, a working dog. Just like there are dogs that are wheelchair service dogs and they're provided with some type of identification, some type of jacket. This is to alert the general public that this is a working type of dog and that you should be respectful of the person. As much as we love to reach out and pay attention to the dog, we should be mindful that this dog does have a job to perform for this person, specific tasks, and part of that specific task is to keep this person safe. And again, that can be a big hindrance if people are paying way too much attention or trying to steer the dog or gain the dog's attention by clapping their hands or trying to make noises at it or reaching out to touch it. Because of the dog's social status, because you want to take it in public, the dog naturally will look or try to pay attention. But again, it can be such a huge distraction for the person. And if they can't see anything at all, it can sometimes be very confusing for them. It can cause them to become turned around, lose their ability to know which direction they're traveling. When that dog does become so distracted, that person and the dog can lose their focus on where they need to go next.
Okay, well, so I think we have a pretty good handle on what to do and what not to do in those situations. Maybe we can circle around to discussing just some sort of more fundamental aspects of Southeastern guide dogs, sort of by the numbers, as it were. I mean, you just mentioned a moment ago that other schools across the country. I mean, how rarefied is Southeastern guide dogs? I mean, I don't get the sense there's a lot of this particular kind of schools, at least in this part of the country.
Correct. We are the only school located in the southeastern part of the United States. There are several other schools up in the Ohio, New York, New Jersey area, California, but we are the only school that services and is established in the southeastern United States. So it is a rare career to be in. You don't find them in every state or every city. So it is something that sometimes in smaller towns people aren't used to seeing. But in most of your big cities, if you pay attention, you will come across somebody using a guide dog.
Sure. Well, this is Talking Animals. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Heidi Ilgen, a longtime trainer with Southeastern Guide Dogs. If you'd like to join the conversation, ask Heidi a question. Please call 813-239-9663, or you can email us at dj@wmnf.org. Okay, well, so let's sort of delve into perhaps the truly central part of this world, at least for many of us. I mean, in broad strokes, maybe you could walk us through the main steps in the process of a dog potentially becoming a guide dog. I mean, it seems like it's a pretty tightly scripted timetable, and at a number of those steps along the way, there's a chance that the dog will move forward, or the dog might veer off into a different path. Maybe you could sort of walk us through that a bit.
Correct. All of our dogs are bred at our school. We have a very strict regimen of the types of dogs that we use, and we try to maintain the quality of the dogs with hips and conformation with OFA and elbows, soundness as far as their personality. It starts from the day they're born. The day that they're born at our school, we have volunteers that start conditioning them with a very soft, gentle touch and getting them used to the positive human reinforcement. Once they reach about 9 weeks of age, they're socialized along the way at our facility, at our campus in Palmetto. But then they're adopted into a family who opens up their heart and their home to raise these puppies for about a year and a half. They're provided with a jacket and identification, and they start socializing these puppies. They not only teach them all of the basics, such as housebreaking and house manners, but they take these puppies everywhere they can possibly take them out into the general public. And they make this a fun experience for these puppies. So they get used to the sounds and the sights and everything that goes on around them that you and I would take for granted. A truck hitting a pothole, making a loud sound, somebody slamming a newspaper box, door slamming, children screaming, sirens going off. All of this is conducive to raising a sound dog that's going to take everything in stride. Once they hit about a year and a half, these puppy raisers have a very heart-wrenching task of bringing these dogs in and turning them back over to our school. And it's not easy for a lot of people because they've had a tough job. I mean, they've had them since they were cute little cuddly puppies, gone through all of the mannerisms, kind of gotten them over the hump and seen them come full circle, and now it's time to send them off to college. And for a lot of people, it's hard for them because they've become very strongly bonded to these dogs and they're unsure of what's going to happen next. Once they come into our school, we have a wonderful team of staff there that takes these dogs and gets them acclimated into a kennel environment. And I know that's hard for a lot of people to understand because they are coming from a home environment into a kennel environment, but that's the only way that we can train and produce the amount of dogs that we need to place with the amount of graduates and applicants that are looking to get a guide dog, because some of them don't make the program. And by that, I mean by sometimes the hips aren't going to qualify for the guide dog program, or with the best raising possible, we may find with the added responsibility of guiding that they do become a little bit more fearful of heavy traffic, or there's some uncertainties that aren't going to qualify them for guide dogs.
Well, yeah. So Heidi, I mean, I think this sort of happens at multiple places along their path, but even in the sort of puppy raising stage, I assume these people, like you say, it's heart-wrenching to give them up and give them back after what they've done and the time they've spent and the bonding they've obviously had with them. But are they also keeping an eye out for other things beyond just hips, but just behavioral things that are now identified as sort of red flags or at least strong pink flags, like, hey, maybe this guy or gal isn't necessarily going to be the guide dog we thought?
Yes, they have a great support system in the puppy raising program. They have what they call area coordinators who are lead people who help get the groups together. They help evaluate the puppies. They can troubleshoot together, and they also can identify potential problems. They also can come back to the school, and we can add added supportive suggestions and ideas, or possibly make the decision early on that this dog may not be successful as a guide dog. But sometimes it's just more time with maturity too.
Sure. So they might overcome some things. But what are some things in those first year and a half or that first period that probably are more regular things that pop up that's like, this is something we either got to watch carefully or again, just give them a little more attention or time or training. Are there certain things that you know, kind of in a small group like that?
Sometimes you'll see a dog that may not be able to handle the intensity of heavy traffic. If you get them out on a city street where the traffic is in close proximity to the sidewalk, the sounds of the traffic are very strong, you may see the young dog showing some subtle signs of maybe just ducking its head down a little bit or trying to move a little bit farther away from the edge of the road to try to get away from that traffic. Sometimes they can even develop a little bit of a nervousness if they've maybe not encountered on a large basis, maybe a gentleman wearing a hat. It can
just
be
certain things that
various,
might kind of unsettle the
various things. But again, a lot of times in the puppy program, it's a matter of a gentle exposure, giving it a little bit more time. And a lot of times they will outgrow this. But again, sometimes they can come back when they come in for their formal training.
And in a sense, I think you kind of already answered this, but are there dogs, puppies, that would start down this path that weren't bred specifically at Southeastern Guide Dogs, or is that the point? Is like, hey, these are dogs that, you know, we've bred and sort of be very careful about, and they're the ones that have the best chance of actually developing in the way that we're seeking.
The school's been in business for over 25 years, and they found through a lot of experience that having the quality of the bloodlines does ensure the best quality of the puppies and the adult dogs, because you can breed in not only health problems, but you can breed in other issues into dogs. So when you pick a very calm male and a female that might have a little bit of a better energy level, but nothing seems to faze that female, and you breed those two dogs together, you get a good mixture of the temperaments that you like to have. And so we found through our quality of breeding and making sure that we find the types of dogs that we need to, and that's why some of the dogs we breed in the puppies, they come in unspayed or neutered, because we may look at that particular line because we like the qualities to continue with that bloodline and continue with that breeding because we see a lot of good qualities in that particular line.
And so I sort of want to continue with this path, but I guess, you know, I can't help but wonder. So the puppies that are identified in that way, that even with some additional training time, nurturing, whatever, just don't seem like they are going to be able to advance down the path to become guide dogs. What happens, or what path do they peel off on, or are there? I mean, I think there's a number of paths actually, but
correct. If they're still a puppy and they haven't come in for their formal training, a lot of times the puppy raiser will just adopt the dog and keep it for themselves as a pet.
Mm-hmm.
If the problems in the dog are not to where they couldn't go into another career, such as a therapy dog,
mm-hmm.
Once they grow up, they can certainly look to get that dog certified in a therapy dog program.
Okay.
If the dog is an adult and it comes into training and we have to make that tough decision to do what we call a career change, because there's never a flunky or a dog that doesn't make it. We don't like to label the dog as,
sure.
as that. We like to call it a career change. There's many other aspects that these dogs can go into. We've placed many, many dogs in search and rescue, arson detection, drug enforcement. The dogs go on to do assistance to our military veterans that have the post-traumatic stress.
Yeah, that's something I want to come back to that in a sec, but go ahead, please. Yeah.
And also, we just started a program, Canine Connections, where we are allowing families to put in an application and adopt a dog that doesn't make our program as a guide dog. And it's for families that have children between the ages of 10 and 17 that are legally blind, and the family is searching the prospect of maybe having a guide dog come into this young person's life in the future. And this helps teach this young person the responsibility of having a dog. And it also helps educate the family if this is the right decision for them as they move forward in their lives. And we just recently placed one with a family in the Orlando area with a young man that was 10 years old. Born severely premature. He was fostered with a family who eventually adopted him. And it's been a wonderful match. They have nothing but praises. And it's been about a little over a week now. And the dog walks with the young man every day to the bus stop. And they're teaching him to feed the dog and even clean up after the dog, although that's not his most favorite thing to do. But it does help educate him on a future of maybe having a dog in his life and possibly
sure.
even a guide dog.
Well, okay, so a couple of questions from what you just said. First of all, what percentage would you say, do move on to these various things you've described as opposed to continuing down the path to become guide dogs?
It's probably about a 10% non-success rate.
Oh, really? I would have guessed a larger percentage mm-hmm. than that. That's
yeah.
interesting. Okay, and then I want to come back to this, but you just touched on something that I am particularly interested in. I mean, the sort of Pause for Patriots program, and I know some of that involves, again, pairing dogs with veterans with visual impairments, mm-hmm. not unlike the guide dogs we're otherwise sort of talking about. But in light of what's going on in the world these days, and especially just lately these days maybe, I guess I'm even more interested at the moment to find out about the dogs that are, as you alluded to, paired with veterans who have post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, first of all, what's that training like, and then what happens from there?
They get a lot of support. We have a qualified trainer who is working in that department to assist these veterans with basic obedience, how to get the dog acclimated to the home, and working with the veteran. It's also an application process. We just don't hand these dogs outright just because somebody is coming back from the war. We want to make sure that they have an understanding of the responsibility of the dog, and the dog gives back. They take the dogs to meetings. It's a good support system. I've had a lot of the veterans tell me that it's sometimes better than any of the counseling that they get, or sometimes even the medicines that they're being told to take, because the dog doesn't tell on them. It doesn't judge them mm-hmm. if they come back with terrible, sometimes life-altering injuries.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes they're horribly disfigured. They're adjusting back to civilian life, sometimes
mm-hmm.
adjusting even in their internal family life. And this dog will sometimes just can read them when they're having a bad day. I had one young man tell me, if I'm having a bad day, the dog comes up and just lays her head on my knee. And that reassurance that the dog gives her kind of calms him down and helps him move on with his day, and really is just a calming effect. And for a lot of them, it helps them get themselves back into the mainstream of civilian life again.
Wow. Yeah. No, it's, just seems, so powerful. And it just seems like, for a dog who didn't, make it as a guide dog, it seems like, it's hard to imagine a sort of more valuable offshoot to their original, intended career. So, okay. So what else then? So when, for example, do you meet, a dog that's, so far succeeded all the way down the path of the puppy raising, et cetera?
Well, they come in about 16 months of age.
Okay.
And we basically start the training the day or day after that they arrive. We spend a couple days just walking them around the grounds and getting to know them and letting the dog get to know us. And we introduce them to the harness. We want to make sure that the dog is comfortable with the harness going on. The puppies are raised with a jacket that goes on them, but they transition into this leather harness as part of their work responsibility. Once we know that the dog is comfortable with this, we start to teach them in a repetitive type of training how to stop for curbs, how to navigate around stuff. And it's done strictly by telling the dog no if it makes a mistake, showing them the mistake and going back and repeating it. And if the dog does something right, we pour the praise on. I always like to say we like to have a party right there at the corner. So if the dog starts to learn, hey, I have to stop before I step off of this curb, we make a big deal out of it. But we squat down, we scruff him around the neck, we give him a good scratch around the ears. The dog's tail starts to wag and it goes, hey, this is pretty cool. You know, I'm getting all this love for stopping right here. The dogs aren't trained for food. They're trained to work for love.
That was actually my next question. So there's really no food reinforcement as part of their training?
No. Yeah. We've done a little bit in the very beginning of training with a lot of the higher energy dogs, maybe to bring their focus in, but it's not something that we incorporate through the whole entire training process. It's just a good way for us to get a quicker response from some of the higher energy dogs to get their focus a little bit quicker.
Okay.
So it's a little less time consuming on us
right,
as trainers.
Right, so you can swing them around to do
no treats and no definitely no human food. That's a big no-no because that can create a monster out of a dog that you may not necessarily want because these dogs are raised to go in the public and they go in and out of restaurants and the biggest compliment is, I never knew there was a dog there.
Yeah.
And that's what we want. We don't really want people to notice that the dog is there.
Sure.
That's the job. The dog is there to do a task. It's there to curl up underneath the chair. And when the person's ready to go, they can stand up. The dog is going back into business and it carefully guides the person out. And that's the biggest compliment is when somebody says, I never knew the dog was there.
Wow. Yeah. Well, no, I guess unseen and unheard aces. Again, this is Talking Animals. My guest is Heidi Ilgen, a longtime trainer with Southeastern Guide Dogs. To join the conversation, if you'd like, please call 813-239-9663 or email us at dj@wmnf.org. Well, I want to continue with where we are, but one of our emailers has said, and maybe just maybe briefly at least address this, Heidi, how does someone go about becoming a trainer for a guide dog? I love dogs and would love to learn more about pursuing this.
Basically, if you have a love for animals and you're seeking out to become a trainer, especially through an accredited school, you just have to go online and research what's available in your area, and you have to apply and you have to get your foot in the door. Certainly, if you have some animal experience, animal husbandry experience, or some type of education in the animal field, it is helpful. But a strong love for animals is top priority because we want the people to be able to go in there and love what they're doing. But in this field, you also have to become a teacher. So it's not just strictly working with the animals. You have to also learn how to take what you're learning and how you're teaching the dog, and you have to be able to incorporate that into teaching the person when they receive the dog. So you have to think, can I be a good dog trainer, but am I going to be a good teacher as well? And I started out over 16 years ago with a strong love for animals and kind of really never even thought about doing the teaching end of it. I spent about 2 years in the kennels working with the animals and working with volunteers that come help walk the dogs. And they saw something in me, and they asked me if I wanted to go into their apprenticeship program. And I said, oh, yeah, I'll give that a try. And it's been going full force ever since. And
wow.
I love the instruction end of it as well as the dog training end of it. So you definitely have to, if you want to become this in this type of field, you have to be able to love to do both, work with people and work with the dogs.
So it sounds like from when you, like kind of way off and the best things happen for anybody, sort of wandered into it, did you just feel like, oh, my gosh, this is exactly the right thing. This is a cool fit for me and what I like to do and my passions and interests and stuff?
Yeah, it was really funny because I was at an apex in my life where I was going to go back to school and actually become a teacher. And a good friend of mine was actually working at the school, and I said, God, that's the greatest job. I would love to get my foot in the door. And she said, we really don't ever hire very often. I said, I don't care if it takes a year. just let me know if there's ever a job opening. And about 6 months later, they happened to have some openings, and I put my application in and very nervously went through several interviews with the CEO and the director of training and talked to them a little bit. And I've always had dogs. I've always grown up with big dogs, German Shepherds, and always just had a great love for animals. My mother said I drug every animal home in the neighborhood if I possibly
could. You were one of those too.
And then when I got the opportunity to learn, and it's an apprenticeship program that you go through. It's a 3-year training process that you go through with a senior trainer that mentors you and teaches you how to not only become the dog trainer, but become the instructor, be the support system, the teacher of this person who's now going to take over this dog for the rest of their lives together. And these dogs work between 8 and 10 years. So you have to teach this person how to basically become the trainer. And they stay at the school for 26 days. And that's tough sometimes because you're out of your home element. You're away from your friends and your family. And so you, as the trainer, have to learn how to be empathetic when necessary or kind of give them a good swift kick every once in a while when they need it and balance it and keep their spirits up as well and encourage them that they can become successful. And I just recently moved into what we call graduate services. And what I do now strictly is support the graduate once they go home with the dog. We firmly believe that we just don't cut you off once you graduate and thank you very much and enjoy your life with the dog. We want to support you for the life of your dog. And so when if you go home and you run into some training issues, some speed bumps as I like to call them, if we can't work it out over the telephone, we'll schedule an appointment. And we'll come see you. So we go to Texas. We go to the Carolinas, Alabama, Arkansas. We travel all over the United States to support these graduates when they go home with their dogs.
Well, gosh, Heidi, we're sort of nearing the end of our time, and I feel like I have a bunch of other things I want to address to you. But let's be sure, among other things, to talk about volunteers, because I really get the sense they're sort of central to the ongoing operation of Southeastern Guide Dogs. And it also looks like from some information I was kind of looking at here that the biggest contingent of volunteers is are the squadron of puppy raisers.
There's all sorts of ways that people can volunteer. You certainly can go on our website at www.guidedogs.org, and they'll give a whole list of different areas from dog walking during the day, puppy hugging, so you can just go in and hug the puppies and help socialize them, walk these dogs when they're in their formal training. It gives them a break from the kennels and training. You can volunteer with the graduates in an enhancement program. You can be a puppy raiser. You can be a host home for one of the breeders. So there's a 1,000 different ways that you can volunteer, depending on your schedule and your lifestyle.
And I would think that although it takes a certain kind of personality, again, be able to hand that dog back after you've been the puppy raiser, I mean, I imagine there's a certain criteria for someone to become a puppy raiser because, again, it's a pretty serious, you know, job in terms of getting that dog on the right path and looking out for things that might be little glitches that people need to address. So is there a kind of a training program, in a sense, for those folks?
Correct. There's an application, and they have to fit a certain criteria. They're given a manual, and again, they're placed with what – in an area where there's generally an AC, an area coordinator. This is a person who's raised many puppies for the school, and they have the experience level to get group meetings together and help evaluate. So there's a strong support system. And I just want to quickly mention that we don't cut these puppy raisers off when they turn these dogs over to us. When they make it as a guide dog, we invite that person who raised that puppy to come to a graduation. They get to see this little puppy that they raised work as a full-fledged guide dog, and they get to meet the person that's being placed with their dog.
Oh,
and,
nice.
It helps people. It encourages them to want to raise again.
Yeah.
And a lot of them strike up wonderful friendships. Our walkathon was just a couple weeks ago, and a lot of the graduates come and they hook up with their puppy raisers again. It's like a little family reunion for them. And it's pretty amazing. This dog will still remember that puppy raiser, but within about 2 or 3 minutes, it quietly settles down by the person's side that it's supposed to be with. Like, it knows that this is their forever home.
Wow. Well, that must be a really sort of poignant moment. Well, we are actually over time, but quickly, I just want to see, because again, I think people might be interested, if not even surprised in some cases, you know, what are the costs associated with training these dogs and their humans at a certain point as well?
It sounds like a lot, but it really isn't. It's $60,000 for a completed guide dog, but that is from birth to completion. That's including the birth of the puppy, all of the shots, the socialization, and all of the formal training, the equipment, and the training of the person when they come in. And it's all done by personal donations, bequests, and fundraisers that we have at the school.
That's great. Well, Heidi Ilgen, thank you so much. And again, speaking of Sandy, who we alluded to earlier, but she's done such a perfect job in the way that you described. We haven't heard her or seen her. We didn't know she was here. So congratulations to Sandy as well. And thanks again, Heidi, for joining us today on Talking Animals. And again, website is guidedogs.org, www.guidedogs.org. Thanks again. Okay, it's time to play Name That Animal Tune, and there'll be a prize. One will be a pair of tickets to see Paul and Fred from Little Feet do an acoustic show tomorrow, March 24th, at the Capitol Theater. And to the first person who calls in 813-239-9663 and that correctly identifies this animal tune, it's Name That Animal Tune. I'm Talking Animals. Can you hear me winking here with this particular one? All right, maybe not. All right, still be a minute. Okay, kind of a gimme. It all hooks together. All right, let's quickly see if one of these folks who did call in. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name the animal tune?
Two Chicken.
That's right. By who?
By Little Feet.
All right. See how it all hooks in. Okay. What is your first name, sir?
Lowell George.
Right. Well, yeah, but Little Feet, who of course these tickets are for. So I mean, the two guys doing an acoustic performance. What is your first name, sir? What is it?
Ben.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. We're going to put you back on hold and get your information and set you up to go see Fred and Paul from Little Feet doing an acoustic thing tomorrow at the Capitol Theater. Thanks for listening. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
All right. Okay, folks, we do have a winner, and going to hear another little animal song here, and then we'll be back with Connie Brooks. We're going to chat with her in a moment. She's locally, well, I'll tell you about it when we get her right back to talk to you. All right, it's Talking Animals. Animal song right here. Okay, it's time to meet Connie Brooks, a locally based and nationally recognized expert on responding to disasters that affect animals and preparing for them and perhaps giving a little sneak preview of the talk that she'll be delivering at the Talking Animals Festival. So, let's welcome Connie Brooks to Talking Animals. Hello, Connie.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Cool.
Thank you.
So it's funny, we touched base over the weekend, and you were in Austin, but actually had nothing to do with South by Southwest, where thousands of other people were in Austin. So maybe you could just briefly sort of address, because I assume you were speaking or at a conference or something down there.
Yes, I was at a conference there, and we were speaking on animal cruelty as well as planning for disasters in your community.
And that, so. And were you speaking on that topic?
Yes.
Yeah, I figured because, you really, as I said in the introduction, I mean, you really have become, sort of nationally recognized as an expert on that topic. And how did that happen? How did you sort of over time, develop that sort of expertise?
Well, I'm a resident of Florida. I grew up in Florida, and so hurricanes have always been around, and we've always had to worry about our pets. And I grew up with pets. So when I was younger, we used to put our pets in the bathroom when we left with 3 days of food and water. That's what we were told to do. And then Hurricane Andrew hit when I started working at SPCA Tampa Bay, and I went down and responded there, and what I seen, it was horrible, and I would, what the animals went through, I knew that we had to be their voice. We had to go out and educate the public to do something to make change. So I was fortunate that Humane Society of the United States started a program, and I jumped on that program and started training and working and trying to educate the public so we never have to see that in our community.
And that seems like that's, again, really become sort of a model program, right, for others across the country?
Yes, actually. The Disaster Animal Response Team is a program that is all over and every community develops one, but our Bay Area Disaster Animal Response Team happens to be one of the largest in the United States. And we've been working very hard at it since 1996 to keep it going. But it is nationally known, and whenever they need help in other areas, they contact the Bay Area DART because we have so many trained responders.
And what are some specific disasters to which you were deployed in recent years?
Well, actually, our team really started deploying the 1998 Florida fires.
Okay.
And then all of the hurricanes in 2004, we worked in the state of Florida. We worked Katrina and Rita in Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
Our team was there actually the whole deployment of Hurricane Katrina from the beginning to the end. And then we unfortunately had turned around 2 years later and had to go to Galveston for Ike, where we found people were still not prepared for disaster with their animals. And,
yeah.
Did not make a plan, and it's unfortunate, and we hope to never see that again. We hope today people really make a plan for their animals because they're part of the family, and the whole entire family matters.
Absolutely. Well, perhaps most immediately, or certainly somewhat immediately, people can come listen to your talk at the Talking Animals Festival on April 3rd. But and you'll be giving that talk at 11:30 a.m. But where else either online or other places where you might speak could people also kind of start to learn more about this and develop a plan for themselves and their household and their animals?
Well, my first recommendation is for people to go online and look up Preparing Your Pets for Disaster. There's lots of wonderful information on there. Humane Society of the United States, ASPCA, but most importantly is your local community animal services. They should have something online on what the plan is for your community because every community is a little bit different.
Sure.
And their resources are different. So it's important that they know what the resources are available in their own community. You can go to the Bay Area DART website. It's www.bayareadart.org. And we have information on there exactly how to make plans for your pets in disaster and what to take with you.
Great. Well, that is fantastic because, again, when people are in the midst of a disaster, they're not thinking as clearly as maybe they would like. And it's great to have, in a sense, it sounds like almost like a sort of a triage of like, okay, well, here's what's important. If you only have, a very limited time, here's what you need to do and grab and bring, to make sure your mm-hmm. animals are in good shape. So.
Exactly. Every disaster is different.
Yeah.
Disasters start from the base. Home fire, disasters start from a small flood in the house. All disasters are different, so you need to be prepared for that. And if you prepare today, then you have everything ready to go, and you already know it, just like you would prepare for your children or your, you know, family members that you have. You, if you're preparing today for them, then you should be preparing for your pets as well, because they depend on you.
Right. That, absolutely. And again, it's just sort of like the idea of, you know, fire drills and any number of other things where you just figure like, okay, well, it seems a little silly to maybe do this or that. But I mean, then when something really happens, you actually know exactly where the exits are, you know where to go, and it's the same idea. And again, sometimes you have such limited time to get moving.
Right, exactly. And there's nothing better than peace of mind.
Yeah.
When you go to sleep at night, you know your family's prepared and your pets are prepared as well. And that's peace of mind. You can do the best you can do under every circumstance, but if you make a plan, it's going to be much easier to follow through on it, worrying about not having a plan.
Well, that seems like the perfect note on which to leave this, because we certainly love peace of mind and we love our animals, and if we can put those two together, then it seems like we're in good shape. So,
absolutely.
So, Connie, thanks again. Again, the best website, it sounds like, from your standpoint, is to go to BayAreaDART.org and find out more. And again, she will be speaking at 11:30 at the Talking Animals Festival on these and other topics. So, Connie, thanks again for making time to join us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, we'll see you April 3rd. Thanks again.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we've just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Again, we're now airing every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to noon, so we'll be back next Wednesday, March 30th, when we're doing a very special edition of Talking Animals. I know, it's a phrase that often means a show has jumped the shark or something like that, but hopefully not in this case. We're going to hold a roundtable discussion in the studio with a little cross-section of participants from the Talking Animals Festival, new and previous, including musician Ronnie Elliott, who will also perform an animal song or two, Veronica Simonetto, a vendor who runs a pet sitting business, Jim Janilek, who's wearing two hats at the festival as both a speaker and a food vendor, and Melinda Diaz, representing rescues and pit bulls, for that matter. So we're going to discuss assorted animal issues, and we'll surely include your calls and emails in the conversation. So that's next Wednesday, March 30th, on Talking Animals at 11 a.m. I hope you'll join me then. I also hope you'll visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals shows. And we've got our Facebook page and Twitter feed and all that stuff there. And there's updates on the Talking Animals Festival. In fact, there's all kinds of announcements and blurbs, everything from bounce houses to soccer collies to our satellite parking locations and more. TalkingAnimals.net. Just on the right-hand side, look for a little banner for festival. Click on that and you'll have so much more information you don't know what to do with yourself. So Talking Animals broadcast outreach consultant is Libby McKenna. My thanks to her. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Stay tuned for the fabulous Scott Elliott with the All Souls version of It's the Music, airing next from noon to 3. And next Wednesday, March 30th, on The Morning Show, Bob Gray, the commuter from hell, will be sitting in for Randy and playing all animal songs. And I'm going to join him, bring some animal songs myself, and give a few inside scoops about the Talking Animals Festival. And may even sneak in on to Scott's show next Wednesday. Briefly, though. Briefly. Don't panic. We're closing out today's show, as always, with an animal tune. And it's new music from R.E.M. with Alligator, Aviator, Autopilot, and a Matter. Say that three times fast. It's Talking Animals.